Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, December 2022 edition. Golden Chocolate by Sherry Monahan. California's famous candy companies have been making the world a sweeter place since 1849. One of California's contributions to our gastronomic history include Ghirardelli, Goodard, and See's chocolates. Ghirardelli and Goodard were born out of the Gold Rush era and are still beloved today. See's is a classic example of family recipes turned into a business. Domenico Ghirardelli, later known as Domingo, was born in Rapallo, Italy, in 1817 to an exotic food importer and was introduced to the chocolate and confectionery trade at a young age and apprenticed with a local candy maker. He arrived in America and in 1849 opened a general store in Stockton, California, where he sold supplies and confections to local miners. He opened another store on the corner of Broadway and Battery in San Francisco. It was 1852 when Domenico opened a confectionery shop under the name of Ghirardelli and Girard at Kearney and Washington Streets in San Francisco, which is now the Ghirardelli Chocolate Company. Their Broma process for processing chocolate was accidentally discovered in 1856 when a Ghirardelli employee discovered a hanging bag of chocolate mass dripping in a warm room. The cocoa butter dripped out and left a residue that could be processed into ground chocolate that produces a more intense chocolate flavor than other techniques. In 1867, they had a chocolate factory at 415 to 417 Jackson in San Francisco, where they also sold Chartres's Rio Java and Manila coffee, ground spices, wine, and liqueurs. They proudly advertised their cocoa was imported from Jarquero, Ecuador. In 1869, Ghirardelli proclaimed they were the sole chocolate manufacturer in California. And in 1871, their best chocolate cost 25 cents per pound. Domingo finally retired in 1892 and turned the management over to his three sons. A year later, they expanded and moved their manufacturing to the newly acquired Pioneer Woolen Building on San Francisco's northern waterfront, which is the present site of Ghirardelli Square. In 1903, Ghirardelli ran a riddle contest for their ground cocoa and offered prizes for the best ones. The San Francisco Chronicle noted, "Riddle making is the rage, the newest fun fad, a merry pastime that has caught on." While Ghirardelli was the well-known name connected with chocolate in San Francisco, Frenchman Etienne Guettard was emerging on the scene. Etienne went to California with the hope of striking it rich during the gold rush. He brought delicious chocolates from his uncle's factory to trade for mining supplies, but learned wealthy miners were willing to pay a premium for it. He realized there was a market for his chocolates, but he wanted to do it right, so he went back to France to finesse his craft. He returned to San Francisco, and between 1869 and 1871, worked with other confectioners until he founded Guettard Chocolate, where he sold chocolate, coffee, tea, and spices. In 1872, Etienne and a partner named Bergen operated the Eureka Coffee, Chocolate, and Spice Mill on Commercial Street. In 1874, a newspaper ad read, "French chocolate manufactured from the choicest cocoa and guaranteed superior to any imported." In 1889, his business had grown and turned into an importer of luxury items, including cocoas, ground and roasted coffee, teas, spices, flavoring extracts, essential oils, and even perfume. They sourced most of their cocoa from around the Pacific, including Indonesia, Hawaii, Ecuador, and Brazil, which made their chocolate unique to the West Coast. Today, you can get a limited edition 62% chocolate that's a throwback to their original chocolate. It's made with beans sourced from the same locations they used when they opened Eureka Works, so you can enjoy a taste of their history. The last historic chocolate company began in the early 1900s with a woman named Mary C. S-E-E. She and her husband ran a hotel in Canada, which is where she developed her now famous candy recipes. After her husband passed away in 1919, her son Charles and his wife moved to Pasadena, California, and asked Mary to join them. Charles planned to start his own candy company using his mother's recipes, so they all moved into a post-Victorian bungalow. Mary made her delicious candy in the bungalow's black and white kitchen and only used the finest and freshest ingredients. Charles opened the first C's Candies in Los Angeles in 1921 and was guided by his mother's values. He made her candy recipes and paid homage to his mother when he opened his first store and designed it to look like their kitchen in the bungalow where she created her candy. His vision came to life with that first shop, and he wanted it to be a place where employees were treated like family and customers were warmly greeted with a free sample. By 1924, C's was offering over 150 varieties to choose from at 80 cents per pound, and in December 1925, they had 10 stores in Los Angeles. Only the finest and freshest ingredients were accepted in their candy kitchen, causing suppliers to coin the phrase C's quality, higher than top quality. C's still uses Mary's original recipes for their peanut brittle, Victoria toffee, and chocolate walnut fudge. Recipe. Note, this recipe was included in a booklet published in 1930 titled Tested Recipes Calling for the Use of Guettard's Ground Chocolate. Guettard Cocoa Cookies. 4 tablespoons shortening. 1 cup sugar. 1/4 cup milk. 1 egg. 2 cups flour. 3 teaspoons baking powder. 1/4 teaspoon salt. 1/2 cup Guettard's cocoa. Cream shortening and sugar together. Add milk and well-beaten egg. Mix well. Sift flour, baking powder, cocoa, and salt together and add. Roll out 1/4 inch thick on floured board. Cut with cookie cutters. Bake in hot oven for 12 minutes. Recipe courtesy of the Guettard Chocolate Company. True West, December 2022 edition. Meet Mrs. Tombstone by Jana Bommersbach. Most places need a committee. Tombstone needed Edna. The town Too Tough to Die was on life support when Edna Landon came to town in 1949. It was still just a rugged town with more past than future. Still a place only remembered for Wyatt Earp and a gunfight near the OK Corral 68 years earlier. Its once majestic courthouse was already falling apart. None of this suited Edna, nor her husband Ted, who retired here from Ohio. But Ted died soon after, and Edna carried on as a one-person savior for the next 18 years, earning her the title of Mrs. Tombstone. Two governors could tell you how tenacious she was, Ernest McFarland and Paul Fannin. Two U.S. senators could attest to her laser focus, Barry Goldwater and Carl Hayden. Both Udall boys knew her well, Stuart and Morris. And they all came to see the same vision Edna had. Earlier this year, Edna Landon was inducted into Arizona's Women's Hall of Fame as one of the latest examples of what a strong Western woman can accomplish. The day she became president of the Tombstone Restoration Commission in 1955 was one of the best days in the town's history. Over the next 2 years, she single-handedly conducted a fundraising campaign to restore the Tombstone Courthouse, writing over 12,000 letters and raising the equivalent of $400,000 in today's money, with donors in 34 states, Alaska Territory, England, and Sweden. After Arizona created the Arizona State Parks Association in 1956, she negotiated the transfer of the Tombstone Courthouse to the association, making the courthouse Arizona's second state park. And she's credited with being largely responsible for Tombstone's recognition as a National Historic Landmark by the U.S. Department of the Interior in 1964, when her buddy Stuart Udall was Secretary of the Interior. But the real true spirit of the woman is revealed in how she raised all that money and sold the world on Tombstone's value. She sold memberships in a Wyatt Earp club. She sold $500 memorial windows in the courthouse. She sold a square foot of Tombstone real estate with a title deed. And she installed public officials and dignitaries as deputy Tombstone marshals. That list included President Dwight Eisenhower, Winston Churchill, Luella Parsons, and the captain of the HMS Queen Mary. She only fell short twice, and both instances are lamentable. She couldn't convince Desilu Studios to film the Wyatt Earp TV show in Tombstone. And she died before she could build an outdoor amphitheater to stage an annual pageant to celebrate Arizona and Tombstone history. Still doable, hint, hint. Hopefully the town will never forget her famous words. If you restore Tombstone, you will be a town to go to. If you let Tombstone go modern, you will be a town to go through. True West Magazine, December 2022 edition. On the Trail of Ashley's 100 by Johnny D. Boggs. An adventure awaits those who follow the western routes of the mountain men. It might not be the most famous advertisement in the annals of Old West history, but when you look at the names who answered the call, it surely ranks up there. To enterprising young men, the subscriber wishes to engage 100 men to ascend the River Missouri to its source, there to be employed for 1, 2, or 3 years. For particulars, inquire Major Andrew Henry near the lead mines in the county of Washington, who will ascend with and command the party, or to the subscriber at St. Louis. William H. Ashley, February 13th. Among those answering the ad, which appeared in the Missouri Gazette, Missouri Republican, and St. Louis Inquirer between February 13th and March 26th, 1822, were Jim Beckworth, Jim Bridger, David E. Jackson, Tom Fitzpatrick, Jediah Smith, and William Sublette. Even Mike Fink tagged along. A Virginia native born in 1778, Ashley arrived at the lead mines in St. Genevieve, Missouri in 1802 and moved to St. Louis in 1819. He became lieutenant governor in 1820, and in 1821, the year Missouri was admitted as the 24th state, he was appointed brigadier general of state militia. Ashley befriended another lead miner, Pennsylvania-born Andrew Henry, who had helped incorporate Manuel Lisa's St. Louis Fur Company and had partnered with Lisa on their upriver journeys, establishing a post at the Three Forks of the Missouri River. St. Louis, Gateway Arch National Park, Jefferson Barracks County Park, Missouri History Museum, had been founded in 1764 by fur traders Pierre Laclede and Auguste Chouteau, while nearby St. Charles, Lewis and Clark Boathouse and Museum, First Missouri State Capitol Historic Site, was home to many workers in the fur trade, including Sublette. Ashley and Henry had competition. The Missouri Fur Company, headed by Joshua Pilcher and Thomas Hempstead had sent a party of 180 men up the river from St. Charles to the mouth of the Bighorn River in present-day Montana. Meanwhile, the French and Columbia's fur companies were hard at work to launch their own expedition. Ashley and Henry were sweating, supplies were late arriving, and a deal for a second keel boat fell through. That led Henry to decide to take more than 100 men on one boat and on horseback to reach the Yellowstone's mouth and have a fort erected before fall. They shoved and rode off on April 3rd. They are described to be of vigorous and masculine appearance, well-armed, and prepared for a three-year tour through the almost unknown and savage country, the New York Spectator opined. This expedition, it is added, can be truly said to be composed of the yeomanry of Missouri, who have embarked in an enterprise which, if they are successful, will not only be very profitable to themselves, but a great national benefit in laying the foundation for an extensive fur trade and proving to the effeminate sons who remain at home that activity is the true source of wealth and greatness. Ashley stayed behind to find another boat and send it when the supplies finally arrived. On May 8th, a keel boat named the Enterprise, commanded by Daniel S.D. Moore, headed up the river with the necessary supplies. Ashley sat back. Richard M. Cloakley wrote in William H. Ashley, Enterprise and Politics in the Trans-Mississippi West, to await reports of the expedition's initial success. The first report, however, wasn't good. Moore returned to St. Louis without his boat on June 3rd. The Enterprise had capsized and sunk roughly 260 miles upstream below Fort Osage, established in 1808 by William Clark, now a national historic landmark in Sibley, Missouri. The men aboard survived, but $10,000 worth of supplies were lost. Before the Mountain Men. This is a good time to point out that the Missouri River wasn't uncharted waters by then. Just across the Illinois state line, at the confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi, Lewis and Clark's state historic site near Hartford features an excellent 14,000 square foot interpretive center and reconstructed camp at Camp River Dubois, the point of departure for the Corps of Discovery. Ashley had work to do. Creditors were still willing to back him, Cloakley writes, but Ashley had to sell his four city lots to help pay for a new keel boat and more supplies. Somehow he came up with 46 new recruits and supplies, including bacon and pilot bread, so the men would not need to rely as heavily on hunting for their supper. Ashley also made another decision. Leaving nothing to chance, Barton H. Harbor writes in Jediah Smith, No Ordinary Mountain Men, University of Oklahoma Press, 2009, he decided to lead the expedition himself. They joined the Enterprise travelers and moved on land and the muddy Missouri. Rolling on the river. They traveled past what's now Council Bluffs, Iowa, historic General Dodge House, Union Pacific Railroad Museum, and to newly established Fort Atkinson at present-day Calhoun, Nebraska, Fort Atkinson State Historical Park. Then through South Dakota and past the mouth of the Grand River near Mobridge, Klein Museum, where Ashley traded with the Arikara Indians for horses that would be needed to get the trappers up the Yellowstone. On October 1st, Ashley and the reinforcements reached Henry's Fort near the Missouri and Yellowstone Rivers. They made plans for the coming enterprise, which would send trappers into Montana, Wyoming, and other fur strongholds. The keel boat arrived 2 weeks later, and Ashley returned with furs, a plan, and a vision. He was back in St. Louis in a month. A new era. Sure, you can find lots of great mountain men stories, and more than 100 legendary fur trappers, scouts, entrepreneurs, and mountain men. But listen to James A. Crutchfield, Western Writers of America's Owen Wister Award recipient, known for his frontier nonfiction. Many fur trade companies existed in North America before William H. Ashley and Andrew Henry set out to engage 100 men to ascend the River Missouri to its source. Many more outfits were organized after the birth of this enterprise, which was the predecessor of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. However, with the likes of Jim Bridger, Milton and William Sublette, James Beckworth, Jed Smith, Thomas Fitzpatrick, and other veteran mountain men on the payroll, few of the other companies could compete with the RMF, and the success of Ashley's brilliant innovation, the rendezvous system. A wide spot in the road. Ulysses S. Grant National Historic Site. Ulysses S. Grant is best remembered for winning the Civil War and not-so-great presidency. Less known is a quiet life spent near St. Louis from 1854 until 1859. After resigning from the Army, Grant settled with wife Julia, whom he married in 1848 on her family's farm. Turns out he wasn't much of a farmer, and by 1860, he was clerking in his father's general store in Galena, Illinois. Once totaling 850 acres, the farmland was sold off over the years, while the home, called White Haven, remained privately owned before the NPS took over in 1989. Today, tours are available inside White Haven, and a horse stable, ice house, chicken house, and summer kitchen also have been restored. This year also marks Grant's 200th birthday, so it's a good time to visit the 9.65-acre site, roughly 10 miles southwest of downtown St. Louis in Grantwood Village, Missouri. www.nps.gov. True West Magazine, December 2022 edition. Bandera, Texas, by Peter Corbett. Cattle drive routes and cowboy cahoots make this hill country town a favorite Old West destination. It's no wonder Bandera is a cowboy town. This is where cowboys converged for longhorn cattle drives on the Western Trail to Dodge City and beyond from 1874 to 94. It's where rodeo thrives today in the town's century-old Manchester Park Arena. Small-town Bandera is big for its britches and proudly wears the title of Cowboy Capital of the World. "First of all, we're from Texas. We brag a lot," said Patricia Moore, Bandera Tourism Office Executive Director. "I'm telling you, this town is bold. It's just flat bold." "This century's cowboys have found us in Bandera," Moore added. "This century's cowboys are motorcyclists who ride into town from all over. Bandera is about an hour northwest of San Antonio. Cowboys and cowgirls come to Bandera to enjoy the western spirit of the town and its notable features. That includes dude ranches, bull riding, barrel racing, junior rodeo, and a professional rodeo cowboys association rodeo on Memorial Day weekend. Rodeo is to Bandera as baseball is to everywhere else, according to Moore. There's also country music, honky-tonks, a local brewery, eateries, unique shops, artisans, and a Western museum in Bandera. The biggest whoop-de-doo of the year is Cowboy Mardi Gras, with beads and boots, a parade, and bands playing at the 11th Street Cowboy Bar. Bandera is home to Arky Blue's Silver Dollar, one of the oldest and best honky-tonks in Texas. The Silver Dollar is in the basement of the Bandera General Store, a 1921 building. It was called the Foxhole in the 1940s. Singer-songwriter Arky Junkie bought the place in 1968 and has performed in the Silver Dollar ever since. Catch him on Saturday nights. A scene from Race with the Devil, a 1975 movie starring Peter Fonda, Warren Oates, and Loretta Swit, was filmed in the Silver Dollar beer joint. For local craft beer, Bandera Brewery has a lineup of creatively named beers with rye cultural references. Fat Guy in a Little Coat, Sharks with Laser Beams, and Very Shagadelic Baby, Yeah. The brewery is family and dog friendly. Wannabe cowboys can visit one of Bandera's guest ranches. The Dixie Dude Ranch has hosted city slickers for 85 years on a ranch established in 1901 by William and Zoe Whitley. It's been in the family ever since. They operate on a 725-acre spread 9 miles west of Bandera. The Mayan Dude Ranch is another family outfit. The Hicks family established the ranch in 1951. Guests can ride trails on 348 acres of hill country. In town, the OST, Old Spanish Trail, Cafe, starting its second century of serving hungry guests breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Leave room for a slice of pie and check out the John Wayne Room, which features photos of the Duke and other cowboys and celebrities. Shop in Bandera at the popular Hi-Oh Silver and the aforementioned Bandera General Store. It was a movie theater and the old Cox Dance Hall long ago. Now it carries a wide selection of cowboy boots and hats, jewelry, antiques, souvenirs, and a soda fountain. Don't miss the Spirits of Texas shop with crafts, clothing, boots, books, furniture, and intoxicating spirits, including musician Kinky Friedman's Man in Black Tequila. 95% of the merchandise is made in Texas. Visitors might also want to take a photo on a saddle-broke longhorn steer, take a wagon ride around town, or grab a bite to eat at a chuck wagon that posts up in Bandera. Finally, history buffs will want to explore Bandera's Frontier Times Museum, a storehouse of the town's colorful past. Hello, this is Michael, reading from the archives of True West Magazine, December 1957 edition. The Real Calamity Jane, in a leather-bound album, now in possession of Mrs. Don C. Foote of Billings, Montana, a legendary character of the Old West reveals some startling facts about herself. By Catherine Wright. Of all the famous women of the Old West, none have been cloaked with more contradictory legends than the notorious Calamity Jane. In the half-century since her death on August 2, 1903, Calamity has been endowed with the vocabulary of a mule skinner, the liquor capacity of a John Barleyhorn, the morals of a Madame Du Barry and Pompadour, and the various attributes and skills of Florence Nightingale, Annie Oakley, Poker Alice, Jim Bridger, and Buffalo Bill. The real woman was astounding enough without the legends. Calamity was born Martha Jane Canary on May 1, 1852 in Princeton, Missouri, rode a spectacular trail that, in the last half of the 1800s, took her into the West's army forts, gold camps, Indian lodges, and boom towns. She scorned the frills of women in saloons she frequented, preferring the buckskin garb of the plain scout. To the public and her casual companions of drinking and gambling houses in towns along stagecoach roads, riverbanks, and immigrant trails, the blue-eyed redhead was a tobacco-chewing, cigar-smoking, hard-drinking product of the frontier, hard as nails and independent as any man. But Calamity left a written record of her life, indicating that beneath her fringed leather shirt beat as feminine a heart as any under a fancy bodice. This record, a series of letters written on cardboard pages of a leather-bound picture album, is owned by Mr. and Mrs. Don C. Foote of Billings, Montana, and is displayed in their museum, Wonderland. Its yellowed pages, filled with a generally unpunctuated scrawl, bring to light Calamity's evidence of her marriage to James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, and their turbulent love, the divorce, and final resumption of that love, justifying the illicit romance with these words: "I was glad to have him again, even if he was married and she so far away. I always excused our sin by knowing he was mine long before he was hers." The diary and a sheaf of other letters and documents, all full of heartbreak, spine-tingling adventures in Indian country, lonely nights by campfires, nights with Wild Bill and a second husband, Charlie Burke, poverty, sickness, and hatred, were accepted by the United States government as Calamity's property and as satisfactory proof of the identity and age of Mrs. Jean Hickok McCormick of Billings. Mrs. McCormick, who left the diary and other mementos to Wonderland Museum upon her death in Billings, February 21, 1951, applied for old age assistance in 1941. After a thorough study and investigation, she was found eligible for aid and on September 6, 1941, was listed in the files of the U.S. Department of Public Welfare as the daughter of Martha Jane, Calamity Jane, Cannery, and James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, born September 25th, 1873, at Benson's Landing. This was an early day settlement near the present town of Livingston, Montana. First entry in the diary was made September 25th, 1877, in Deadwood, Dakota Territory, and is headed, "To Jim O'Neill, please give this album to my daughter, Janie Hickok, after my death. Jane Hickok." Jim O'Neill was Captain James O'Neill, a sea captain who maintained a home in Richmond, Virginia. Calamity had given her daughter to O'Neill for adoption in 1874. In Deadwood, September 1880, Calamity wrote in her diary, "Janie, a letter from your daddy, Jim, came today, and another picture of you. Your picture brought back all the years I lived with your father and recalled how jealous I was of him. I feel like writing about him tonight, so I will tell you some things you should know. I met James Butler Hickok, Wild Bill, in 1870 near Abilene. I heard a bunch of outlaws planning to kill him. I couldn't get to where my horse was, so I crawled on my hands and knees through the brush, past the outlaws for over a mile, and reached the old shack where Bill was staying that night. I told him, and he hid me back of the door while he shot it out with them. They hit him, cutting open the top of his head. Then they heard him fall and lit matches to see if he was dead. Bill killed them all. I'll never forget what he looked like with blood running down his face while he used two guns. He never aimed, and I guess he was never known to miss anyone he shot at. I mean, those he wanted to kill. He only shot in self-defense. Then he was quite sick. I nursed him several days. And then while on the trip to Abilene, we met Reverend Sipes, and Reverend Warren and we were married. There will be lots of folks doubt that we were ever married, but I will leave you plenty of proof that we were. You were not a woods colt, Janie. Don't let any of those pus-gutted blatherskites get by with that lie." Warning her daughter against jealousy, Calamity continued, "It, jealousy, kills love and all the nice things of life. It drove your father from me. When I lost him, I lost everything I ever loved except you. I gave him a divorce so he could marry Agnes Lake. I was trying to make amends for the jealous times and my spells of meanness. If she had loved him, she would have come out here with him. But she didn't, and I was glad to have him again, even if he was married and she was so far away. I always excused our sin by knowing he was mine long before he was hers. Hickok, who was shot in the back of the head in a Deadwood saloon on August 2, 1876, married Mrs. Agnes Lake in Cheyenne, Wyoming, March 5, 1876. He left shortly afterward for the Black Hills. Agnes never saw him again. According to Hickok's early biographers, she moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and was living there in 1880. Meanwhile, the West's foremost woman scout was in Deadwood, nursing a broken heart and wounded vanity. Chronic ailments that had plagued her since her marriage to Bill 6 years before. Womanlike, she decided to snub him, should their paths cross again. She quickly discovered that such a course was impossible for her to follow. We met one day, and we both found we still loved each other better than ever. I forgot everything when I was near him. No one else ever knew. If anyone hinted such to me, I hauled off and knocked them down. He denied it also. We both lived a life of lies. He was meant for me, not Agnes Lake, or he would have stayed with her instead of coming back to me. Of her second marriage, Calamity wrote on September 25, 1891, I did a crazy thing some time ago. I married Charlie Burke. He got me in a weak moment, and we were married. What became of Charlie? There is no later reference to him, except a brief mention in a letter Calamity wrote to Captain O'Neill, June 20, 1898, from Stringtown, now Bridger, Montana. I am so blue and disgusted with life. I have Belle Starr's little girl with me. Her father was Bill's cousin. She worries me to death. Burke is so mean to her. I have gotten so I hate him. A respite from Burke and Belle Starr's little girl came in August 1893 when Calamity joined Colonel William F. Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show and toured eastern states and England. Some of Cody's biographers relate that Calamity's career as a member of the troupe was short-lived because of her excessive drinking. Of that tour, Calamity wrote bitterly a few years later, 4 years have slipped by, and I am back in Deadwood. I am tired and feel so old. I am nursing again. I can always fall back on that. I got so lonely for our old West and so disgusted with gadding all over the world. Lord, how I hate England with its snobs, its good-for-nothing women with their put-on airs. They forget that they were thrashed by a handful of Americans not so long ago. I felt like shouting it from the treetops. I never saw so many parasites as there are in England, especially the women with their blokes, just because they have handed down one generation to the next some bed-buggy estate, they get the idea they are aristocrats, or in plain words, just plain paupers. Obviously, the trip was an unhappy experience for rough-and-ready Calamity Jane. It must also have been an edifying experience for the English women with whom she came in contact. Of Billings, Montana, where she is remembered by many old-timers, Calamity was equally vituperative. Billings, she wrote, is some lively town. It supports about 1,500 toughs. These are hectic days, like hell let out for noon. These human parasites prosper, both men and women. The respectable citizens of the town are powerless. They can't even control the elections. The police figure they would risk complete annihilation by attempting raids on the dens running at top steam. Block after block is appropriated, composed entirely of saloons and sporting houses. In the center of this whirlpool of saloons and dives may be seen the house of Madame Feely, the hub from which the lesser spokes in the wheel radiate. Any old-timer in the Yellowstone Valley can tell about Feely's house. It is a large building with brilliantly illuminated windows. A force of professional bouncers are maintained by the establishment to preserve a degree of peace. Madame Feely reigns supreme. She is an anomaly, a mighty attractive woman, neither ruthless nor unscrupulous. Located near the Yellowstone River is an inferior spoke in the wheel. In its basement are evil, dirty-smelling, poorly lighted dens, vile and dangerous, where a trap door opens directly into the river to accommodate those who just can't take it. More often, they are robbed and dumped into the river because the gang thinks they're spies or stool pigeons. I am telling you this because I want you to know the sort of world we have here. So Calamity found Billings in 1893. How Billings found Calamity 9 years later was chronicled in the Billings Gazette, November 21st, 1902. The account reads, "Calamity Jane is in trouble and in jail again. For some times past, she has been acting more than unusually unruly and has committed several overt breaches of the peace. Among her more recent escapades was one of yesterday, and which would have resulted seriously but for the timely interference of a bystander. Without any apparent reason, save that suggested by a mind more or less overstimulated by her favorite tipple, Jane armed herself with a hatchet and invaded Yeegan Brothers' store and attempted to put an end to one of the young ladies employed in the dry goods department. She advanced toward her with hatchet uplifted and said she was going to chop her to pieces, then and there. It may have been only one of Jane's practical jokes, but the victim, having little sense of humor, screamed for help. One of the male clerks disarmed the belligerent Calamity and assisted her from the battlefield. No complaint was made, and she retired in order. This morning, Calamity visited another store on the south side and again threw down the gauge. She was promptly arrested and would be tried this afternoon should she be sober enough to face the bar of justice. It is deemed likely that she will receive a sentence long enough to give her time to sober up." Besides her love for liquor and fights, Calamity also had a domestic streak, as shown in a diary entry in which she tells of purchasing land west of Billings. She wrote, "I have a cabin of logs on it. There is a shack not very far away from my hut and a bunch of outlaws living there. I cook lots of things for them, and they pay me well for everything. I baked 2 dozen loaves of bread this week, 8 cakes, 15 mince pies. I'm going to write down my recipes for you. Maybe someday you might like to know if I could cook or not. I am proud of my cooking, especially of my fish, dishes, cakes, and pies." The outlaws apparently didn't pay Calamity enough, for the land went to taxes a few years later. Some rotting logs and a crumbling stone fireplace chimney remain as mute evidence of her residence there. Whether Calamity realized her land was gone is a question. In June 1903, back in Deadwood, ill and nearly blind, Calamity scrawled, "I am sick and haven't long to live. I am taking many secrets with me, Janie, what I am and what I might have been. I am not as black as I've been painted. I want you to believe that. If you ever come out here, fix up my old home and be sure to find General Allen of Billings. He was a good friend." Knowing her time was short, Calamity sent for Captain O'Neill and in his presence laboriously wrote a confession which fills the last pages of the album. I, Jane Hickok Burke, better known as Calamity Jane, of my own free will and being of sound mind, do this day, June 3rd, 1903, make this my confession. I have lied about my past life. To help clear up my daughter's birthright and my sister's daughter's birth, I am making this confession to James O'Neill to make public or to keep to himself. I was born in Missouri. I had several sisters, but only one is to be mentioned in this. People got snoopy, so I told them lies to hear their tongues wag. The women are all snakes, and none of them I can call friends. All letters and information given prior to this are lies, except the diary I have kept for Janie since 1877. The only lie in that is where I said Belle Starr was no kin of mine. She was my sister, raised by Ben Waddell and his wife. They were killed in the 80s in Oklahoma. They never knew our relation. After their death, Belle came to me under the name of Starr. She married William Hickok, cousin to my daughter's father, James Butler Hickok. I lied about having a daughter born to me in 1887. I nursed my sister Belle at that time. She gave birth to a girl whom she named Jessie Elizabeth. Then Jack Oakes came from Fort Pierre. Hickok believed the worst of his wife. He was ashamed of her doings and refused to live with her. She lived with Jack Oakes, and to them was born a son, Charlie Oakes. Jessie Elizabeth was born October 28, 1887, near Benson's Landing, where Janie was born September 25, 1873. Belle posed as my daughter and Jessie Elizabeth as my granddaughter. They were neither, for Belle was older than I am. Charlie's father murdered a man in Fort Pierre. I have been called the common law wife of King, Sonyers Wilson, and Dorset. I was legally married to Hickok and Burke. I dare anyone to deny these facts. Signed, Jane Hickok Burke. Those who signed as witnesses were James O'Neill, R.R. Ryan, and N.K. Sipes. Calamity's claim of marriage to Hickok has been generally denied and ridiculed in after years, and Calamity herself kept it hidden during her lifetime. Death on August 2, 1903, brought her openly to a permanent association and place with Wild Bill. Their graves lie side by side in Deadwood's Mount Moriah Cemetery. True West Magazine, November 2022 edition. Zane Grey's Arizona and New Mexico by Johnny D. Boggs. A backroads tour of the Western author's two favorite states leads to small towns, historic sites, and awe-inspiring natural wonders. The feud wasn't as bloody as the one Zane Grey wrote about in To the Last Man, but one thing is certain. Grey could carry a grudge. If you believe some media reports, the vendetta started in 1929 when Grey appealed to Arizona's game warden to hunt bears that were hugging many of his delectable pigs to death near his cabin along Tonto Creek below the Mogollon Rim east of Payson, 2 weeks before the bear season began. Another, more believable, report said he arrived 2 weeks early, unaware that the state had moved back bear hunting season. Either way, the warden refused to issue Grey a hunting license. Grey was an avid hunter and angler. In 1924, Winchester Repeating Arms Company presented him an 1895 sporting rifle, which now is part of the Cody Firearms Collection at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. He had visited Arizona often and painted that state's landscape in prose that was a deeper shade of purple than his Utah sage. He and his wife, Dolly, honeymooned at the Grand Canyon's El Tovar Hotel in 1906. He once told Flagstaff's The El Cocino Sun that no place in the West calls to me as does the broad and magnificent stretches of open country. The vastness, the color, and magnificence of Arizona is incomparable. He had built his cabin in 1920-21 in his beloved Tonto Basin, with views of the Mogollon Rim, the setting for many of his novels. Many film adaptations of Gray's novels had been shot on location across the state. Insulted? That was just part of it. Gray said he had spent $30,000 in Arizona just to write To the Last Man. In 1930, Time magazine reported Gray as saying, "But this is not the only reason I shall not write any more about Arizona. The Game Commission and the Forest Service have gone over to the commercial interests. The Grand Canyon on the North Rim is a tin can gasoline joint, and the hunting season is a shambles." Seeing an opportunity, New Mexico Governor Richard C. Dillon extended Gray this offer. "I want to suggest that you move bag and baggage over to New Mexico," the Santa Fe New Mexican reported, "where you will find a rich field for your marvelous genius, where our game department will treat you fair and square, where you will find a powerful landscape and a local history teeming with thrilling and brilliant romance, and in readiness for your masterly pen. Also, where you will find a warm welcome from our people. Think it over." New Mexico didn't replace Arizona as Gray's Mecca, but he never returned to Arizona. The first chapter. Born in 1872 in Zanesville, Ohio, check out the National Road Zane Gray Museum, Pearl Zane Gray grew up to become a baseball player and dentist. As a dentist, he entertained his patients with stories of his prowess as a fisherman. The Albuquerque Tribune wrote after Gray's death in 1939, one of them encouraged him to write those tales, and thus began the career of Zane Gray. His first novel, Betty Zane, 1903, was set in frontier West Virginia. His first success was The Heritage of the Desert, 1910, set between the Grand Canyon and the Utah border. He later settled in Altadena, California, but traveled to the locations he would write about. Riders of the Purple Sage, 1912, set along the Arizona-Utah border, launched him to superstardom. He didn't always wow critics, but as scholar Charles G. Pfeiffer wrote in 1989, at one time in the United States, he ranked only behind the Bible and McGuffey's readers in sales. Of Gray's 58 adult Western novels, Pfeiffer cites 23 that are at least partially set in Arizona. Second place is New Mexico with 7. But Gray wrote fiction. He moved things around to fit his story. Arizona. Most of the Arizona novels were set in the Rim Country, which he first visited in 1918. From 1921 to 1929, he came to hunt, fish, and write, including To the Last Man, 1922, based on the Tewksbury-Graham feud in the Pleasant Valley, and Under the Tonto Rim, 1926. Though he had disowned Arizona by the time the books were published as novels, Gray's Arizona Ames, 1932, Code of the West, 1934, and Arizona Clan, 1958, were also set in the region. The Tonto Basin Cabin burned in the massive 1990 Dude wildfire that killed 9 firefighters, but a replica was built and dedicated in 2005 as part of Payson's Rim Country Museum. Gray wrote part of Riders of the Purple Sage at Flagstaff's Weatherford Hotel. He also contributed funds for Flagstaff's Hotel Monte Vista, which opened in 1927. The Call of the Canyon, 1924, took place around Oak Creek Canyon. 30,000 on the Hoof, 1940, on the Mogollon Rim, and the Deer Stalker, 1949, around the Grand Canyon. The Rainbow Trail, 1915, Lost Pueblo, 1954, and The Vanishing American, 1925, were set on the Navajo Nation. The 1925 silent film adaptation of the latter is arguably the best movie made from a Gray novel. He visited southern Arizona, too. Desert Gold, 1911, is in the silken seep of sifting sand near the Mexican border. Gray's 1923 short story, Tappan's Burrow, mentions the lost Dutchman's mine near Apache Junction, Superstition Mountains Museum. New Mexico. The Lost Wagon Train, 1936, is set in northeastern New Mexico along the Santa Fe Trail, while Knights of the Range, 1939, loosely based on the Maxwell Ranch, is set in Cimarron, Aztec Mill Museum. The village of Magdalena pops up in Valley of Wild Horses, 1947, while the Pelencillo Mountains near New Mexico's Boot Hill appear in The Light of Western Stars, 1914. One of Gray's most interesting novels, The Shepherd of Guadalupe, 1930, takes place around Las Vegas, New Mexico, City of Las Vegas Museum, and is set immediately after World War I. While his New Mexico writings aren't as numerous as Arizona, Gray played an important part in New Mexico tourism. As Kevin S. Blake wrote for Geographical Review in 1995, in The Vanishing American, he further popularized the desert by calling it a land of enchantment, a phrase New Mexico adopted as its slogan in the 1930s. Epilogue. Zane Gray died of a heart attack at his Altadena home on October 23, 1939. In the 1960s, Arizona eventually called a truce by attempting to name a stretch of Highway 260 the Zane Gray Highway. That didn't sell nearly as well as the Rainbow Trail, 1915, though, and today the road is more often known as General Crook's Trail. And New Mexico? Well, it discovered Tony Hillerman. The Navajo Nation has Monument Valley, Arizona, has Old Tucson and Sedona. But an often overlooked Western film setting is Red Rock Park, just east of Gallup, New Mexico. While filmmakers discovered Gallup as early as 1915, The Great Divide, the park's red cliffs, Pyramid Peak, Church Rock, and other sites might be familiar to fans of 1940s and 50s Westerns. Pursued, 1947. Four Faces West, 1948. Colorado Territory, 1949, Ambush, 1950, Rocky Mountain, 1950, Raton Pass, 1951, Escape from Fort Bravo, 1953, and Fort Massacre, 1958, are among the Westerns filmed there. The park includes a campground, reservations required, and trails. It is also the site of the Gallup Intertribal Ceremonial each August. In 1922, Zane Gray attended the inaugural Indian pageant and celebration and called it a great success.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.